I'm taking a survey here, sir, and I wonder if you'd mind answering a few questions.
Oh, it's okay with me, lady. Shoot.
First one is, which would you be more willing to go to war to defend, the Hawaiian Islands or Canada?
Hawaii? Mm-hmm. Well, why should we go to war to defend any place that belongs to a foreign country? But Canada. Now, they're our neighbor. Yeah, I guess I'd choose Canada. Yeah, you can put me down for that.
Thank you very much. And now...
Say, by the way, it sort of slipped my mind, but just who does own the Hawaiian Islands?
Why, we do. The United States.
The National Broadcasting Company presents The National Hour. This is a mirror of public opinion, reflecting what America and the world are thinking, planning, doing. This is today's interpretation of the problems and the newsworthy milestones that we must reach and pass on the road to peace and reconstruction. Today, July 21st, 1946, we present the 36th in the distinguished NBC series, The National Hour. Our subject for today,
A Star for Paradise, Statehood for Hawaii.
This is Robert St. John in New York. On the agenda of the present Congress, there's a bill to change the status of the Hawaiian Islands from a territory to the 49th State of the Union. This program, then, is a consideration of this candidate for statehood and a consideration of its growth. And to typify the points of view on this complex question, from Honolulu on the island of Oahu, we shall call in the former Hawaiian delegate to the United States Congress, Mr. Samuel W. King, and from Washington, we'll hear from Congressman Henry D. Larcade.
This is Robert McCormick in Washington, and it's here that the decision on statehood for Hawaii will be made. And representing the islands in Congress is the territorial delegate, Joseph R. Farrington. Later in this program, we shall ask Mr. Farrington to tell us of the office he holds. We are standing by.
Mind if I sit down, Tom?
What difference would it make? Next time, ask me before you sit down. And before you tell me, I'll tell you that the flag manufacturing business is kaput right now, so you can't make a touch, and I haven't got a job for you.
Relax, fella. I came here to do something for you. I want to invest in your business.
Oh? Well, what's the gag?
No gag. The flag manufacturing business is in for a boom.
Oh, yeah, like an atom bomb exploding. The war is over. Everybody's got enough flags.
Sure. But in a few months, every flag may be out of date.
Oh, you don't say. And you're right in on it, huh? Say, look, I'm not interested in your opinions.
So we're even. But suppose next month, or 6 months from now, or even a year, suppose the American flag suddenly gets a new star. Suppose a new state comes into the Union.
But how? Where would the new state come from?
From Hawaii.
Hawaii?
Yep, the land of the ukulele and the hula girl. They want to join the Union. Here, read for yourself.
Hawaii. I thought that was a foreign country.
Yeah, about as foreign as Abe Lincoln.
But how the devil did we ever come to own Hawaii?
You'd be surprised at how many of us aren't aware of the fact that this paradise of the Pacific is an American territory. In January 1940, for example, a national magazine conducted a survey. That survey disclosed that more Americans were willing to defend Canada than the Hawaiian Islands, which are a territory of the United States. For the benefit of the residents of the 48 states, here is a rapid identification of that territory, which seeks legal adoption as the 49th state.
The 8 main islands and the dozen smaller ones known collectively as the Hawaiian are in the Pacific Ocean near the northern limits of the tropics. From California, they are 100 hours away by boat and 10 hours away by plane.
The largest of the islands is Hawaii, but Honolulu, the tourist delight, isn't there. It's on Oahu, a smaller island to the westward.
The territory is somewhat smaller than Connecticut and Delaware combined. The area of productive land is only about 20 miles square and supports more than 500,000 people.
The main industries are sugar, pineapple, and tourists. For diversification, the islands also produce cattle, poultry, coffee, papayas, bananas, honey, and coconuts.
Yet Hawaii was unknown to the Western world until 2 years after our Declaration of Independence. It fell to Captain James Cook, the English navigator and explorer, to stumble on paradise early in the morning of Sunday, January 18, 1778.
In thy wisdom and justice, O Father, thou hast given to us this day in which to think of thee and all whom thou dost love. Forbid the thrill of the selfishness. Well, I'm at your penis.
Lord, Captain Cook. Here's the glass, sir.
Thank you. What? These islands aren't marked on our charts.
Shall we head for them, sir?
Aye. Prepare the longboats for landing.
Aye, Captain.
Silence! Silence, men. We will continue with our prayer. Oh, Lord, forbid that through our selfishness the day should be hard for others. Accept, we pray, the worship of loving hearts.
My father, who are these men white in face that came with the great boats?
They are not men as we are. They are the gods, my son.
Then Lono has come back to us as we were told.
He has come bringing us many gifts, as we were told. We have waited long. Now we have been chosen.
Have we not seen? These whites are not gods. They are as we are.
They have destroyed our idols. They have burned them in their fires. Look, there they blaze.
They killed my husband.
Many have been killed.
They are going to their boats to sail away. Our dead must be honored. Their chief must be killed as he killed.
The body of Captain Cook never left the islands. For 7 years after his death, no vessels came there. But 8 years later, I, Benjamin Holcomb, arrived on the island and became a planter. For the first time, all the islands were united under Kamehameha I, called the Napoleon of the Pacific. He encouraged his people to return to the soil and make it fruitful again. He worked his own taro patch and spent much time among his subjects. Once I took occasion to compliment the king on this democratic practice.
What? Does not your king do the same?
The British king moves among his people very little.
Have you ever seen him, Mr. Holcomb?
No, never.
Then how does he know what the people want?
Well, he has other people find out for him.
Nobody can find out for me as well as I myself. Mr. Holcomb, my people wish for peace, and they shall have it. For I have said, let the aged, men and women, and little children lie down in safety in the road.
Kamehameha had brought peace and a measure of prosperity to his people. But little by little, I saw the good, simple life of the island passing. Two irresistible forces were changing its civilization. First the missionaries, then the businessmen. The great wave of change began in 1819 with the death of Kamehameha and the accession of his son, Liholiho the Broadbacked. In the following year, there arrived an American Congregationalist missionary party, accompanied by three Hawaiian boys who had been indoctrinated in New England. I took them to visit the new king. The native lad, Hopu, spoke to the king at some length. The king answered, and the leader of the missionaries turned eagerly to Hopu.
What did the king say, Hopu? Why did he point to the Bible?
Mr. Bingham, the king wants to know about the marks on the pages, what they are. He thinks they must be eye medicine because you look at them so long.
Hopu, the Lord is with us today. You are his lieutenant. You have a wonderful opportunity. Seize it. Explain that we are here to teach, that these marks are signs, that they stand for objects, people, thoughts. Hopu, convert Liholiho, and we convert the islands.
Mr. As I surmised would happen, the first steps of the missionaries were stumbling and painful. One of the first converts was Queen Kamamalu, Leolio's favorite wife. And with great zeal, she nagged her husband to accept the religion imported by Mr. Bingham. And the more the queen nagged, the more exasperated became the king.
Sire, will you come to church with me today?
No, not today.
Oh, but you gave your word.
I have business and can't go. No more words.
Please, why don't you join with us Christians?
And if I do, then you won't be happy.
Why?
If I become a Christian, they will allow me only one wife.
Oh, I will be happy then.
No. For that wife will not be you.
The missionaries and the businessmen stayed on and prospered, but it soon became clear to us that the businessmen resented the Puritan enforcements of the preachers. In turn, the preachers fulminated against the practices of the businessmen.
Mr. Adams, I consider the sale of that mirror thievery, not a business transaction.
I hardly see why you should be so upset, Mr. Bingham.
Charging that native $400 for a mirror that's worth $40? And you don't see why I'm upset, Mr. Adams?
Money does not always roll in the way souls do. And when it does, then I have to make 600%.
It's wrong and despicable.
I am merely answering a demand. All these native women want satin and silk. You can't keep them from buying it, even if they don't have poi enough in the house for another meal. And if I don't sell it to them, somebody else will. What if I did sell the chief a $40 mirror for $400? He's got plenty of sandalwood to pay for it.
Mr. Adams, these natives are Christians, too. I cannot and will not close my eyes to such practices.
Mr. Bingham, saving souls is your business, and I do not interfere. Selling mirrors and other articles happens to be my business, and I can do without interference from you.
In the month of February 1823, there were 24 vessels at anchor in Honolulu Harbor, most of them American whalers. The population of the village was between 2,000 and 3,000. Trade was brisk, and there were four mercantile establishments. The natives had begun to dress in civilized style. Many learned to read and write, and numbers embraced Christianity. But among the common people, poverty and misery were on the increase.
That was the state of affairs in the Paradise of the Pacific in the year that Benjamin Holcomb died. In the year following, Europe and America, seeking new areas for investment and exploitation, found the islands a big interest-bearing paradise. The plantations of sugar and pineapple needed capital, and the capital came from America, from England, from Germany. The plantations needed cheap manpower, and the manpower was imported from China, Japan, Korea, Portugal. And by 1890...
Frank, what's wrong?
Nothing, Alice. Nothing for you to worry about.
Ever since you came back from the States last week, you seem troubled. What is it? Certainly you can talk about it to your wife.
Yes, yes, we can talk about it, but I'm afraid there's nothing we can do. You see, I have a strange feeling that soon, under some pretext, the islands are going to be seized.
Seized? By whom?
By England or Germany or by my own country, the United States. Alice, I don't like what's happening. While I was in the mainland, I found out many things. I saw it all set down in neat figures. Native Hawaiians now own less than a third of the land and have only 6% of the capital invested in business. Now, these figures are the handwriting on the wall.
Then it's too late. We're too few to try to stop what's happening.
But we're not too few. 80,000 natives, Chinese and Japanese, dominated by only 5,000 whites, mostly Americans.
But they have the power.
Yes, yes, they have the power. And when they're ready, they'll shake down the islands like a ripe plum from a tree.
In the year 1891... a representative of the island's sugar interests conferred with an influential senior senator in Washington, D.C. Subject of the conference, further shaking of the bough on which hung the plum.
Senator, something will have to be done, and soon.
You know where I stand, Mr. Wilcox. But many eyes are watching. This must be handled tactfully. Very tactfully.
But we can't waste time. There's a depression in the islands. The beet sugar industry on the mainland hit us hard. Now McKinley's tariff bill...
I fought tooth and nail against that bill.
Oh, we're not holding you to account for it, Senator. But the bounty that's going to be paid to the sugar growers and millers means that we cannot compete with mainland sugar any longer.
I realize that, Mr. Wilcox. But we cannot make any moves to annex the island simply on the sugar issue. It's too clumsy.
Well, there are other reasons that can be given to the public. Queen Liliuokalani, who just came to the throne, is against all foreigners. She wants Hawaii for the Hawaiians. She is ready to overthrow the Constitution of 87.
That is bad. That is very bad indeed.
Think a minute, Senator. You'll see that it is not bad. If the Queen goes through with her plans, and we're certain that she will, then we can join with the natives in a revolt against her autocratic rule. Well, Senator?
Oh, most perfect, Mr. Wilcox.
And perhaps at the crucial moment, a detachment of Marines might quite coincidentally be offshore and ready to aid Americans in distress.
Perfect, Mr. Wilcox. Perfect.
The popular revolt against the Queen, who had composed Aloha Oi, went off according to plan, and a treaty of annexation was laid before the Senate by President Harrison. And there it collapsed. And then came the war with Spain, and once more the debate broke forth on the Hawaiian resolution. The Republican view was stated by the chairman of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs.
Mr. Speaker, the importance of the question lies first of all in the necessity of possessing these islands for the defense of our western shore, the protection and promotion of our commercial interests, and the welfare and security of our country generally. Mr. Speaker, the Democratic Party holds and has held that the so-called revolution was affected by chicanery, that annexation is being fostered by American speculators. The plea of naval defense is nothing but the professional rhetoric of the professional imperialist. We are told that we need these islands as a strategic base in military operations. All the admirals, rear admirals, generals, colonels, majors, and captains say so. But how does it happen, then, that we have gotten along splendidly for 109 years without these volcanic rocks?
But whatever the merits of the arguments or the skill of the debaters, the Republicans had a majority in both houses. And by a joint resolution, the Hawaiian Islands were formally annexed on July the 7th, 1898. The paradise of the Pacific became part of the United States.
Prosperity followed annexation, prosperity, and the heavy fortification of Pearl Harbor. And with annexation came political vexation.
Look, John, I've been thinking, and I'm serious. All these Chinese and Japanese being born now are automatically American citizens. Do you realize that within the next 25 years, we can be completely outvoted by the Orientals?
Five years and two world wars later, that attitude was put to the test in a night-covered foxhole in Italy.
You don't have to stay here, soldier.
What do you mean?
If you don't like sharing this foxhole with me, you can find yourself another one.
What did I say?
Nothing. But you'll spoil your eyes staring at me so hard in the dark. What's the matter? Think I'm a spy?
Now, look, God, don't get me wrong. It's just this is the first time I ever saw... Well, saw... Well,
go on, say it, a Jap.
I heard about the job you guys in the 100th Battalion did.
We just did what we had to do.
Yeah, and that's what I don't get.
What?
Well, ever since Pearl Harbor, I've been hearing and reading stories about the Japanese.
Yeah, sure, I know. Let me make it easier for you. I was born and raised and educated in Hawaii. That makes me an American.
Well,
Yes, of Japanese ancestry. In grammar school, I pledged allegiance to the flag like you did, and I meant it. I sang Land Where My Fathers Died, and it didn't seem a bit funny either, and it doesn't now. So you see, I've got a right to be here, just like you or any other American. Any more questions?
Nope. And brother, you remind me of home. You're as touchy as a Texan.
Get yourself some shut-eye. I'll call you if the general wants you.
All right.
In 1945, Hawaii's half-million population paid $174 million into the federal treasury, and the proponents of statehood in the islands have revived the slogan, "No taxation without representation." The Hawaiian Islands do have a delegate in Congress, but can a delegate really represent his constituents, or is he just a voice without a vote? To answer these questions, we now present from our Washington studio the Honorable Joseph R. Farrington, delegate from Hawaii.
The people of Hawaii have been represented in Congress for more than 46 years now by only one delegate. He has a voice in committee and on the floor of the House, but he has no vote in either, and not so much as a voice on the floor of the Senate. The needs of the people of the territory cannot be adequately met within the limitations of this form of representation. The people of the territory, moreover, feel that they have a contribution to make to this country that cannot be fulfilled without the voting representation in the Senate and the House that would come with statehood. Hawaii's population today either exceeds or is close to that of some dozen states. The territory normally pays more taxes into the federal treasury than 14 to 16 states. Through a period of many years now, the people of the islands have demonstrated beyond question their capacity to manage their own affairs. Hawaii is a highly prosperous and progressive American commonwealth whose industrial, commercial, and cultural life have been developed in the best tradition of America. The territorial form of government has served well in bringing about this development, but it no longer meets the requirements of this vigorous and growing community. The time has now come to give the people of the territory the responsibilities and privileges commensurate with their growth. The time has come to make Hawaii a state.
Thank you, Delegate Farrington.
On November 5th, 1940, the citizens of Hawaii went to the polls to record their desire in a plebiscite recommended by a joint congressional committee. On the ballot was one question.
Do you favor statehood for Hawaii? 67% voted in favor of statehood. In the following year, a Gallup poll in the United States on the same question found the same proportion in favor.
Now, for a first-hand account of public sentiment in the islands, the National Hour travels to Honolulu. We will hear from Mr. Samuel W. King, former Hawaiian delegate to the United States Congress and a United States naval captain during the war. Mr. King will tell us just what statehood would mean to Hawaii. Mr. King.
Hawaii is deeply gratified at the great progress made in recent months towards statehood. We have never doubted since Hawaii was annexed in 1898 that in accordance with the principles on which the American nation was founded, Hawaii would eventually become a state. As the years passed by, more of our own citizens and of our friends on the mainland felt that the time had now arrived to complete the final step in the sequence of events commenced by annexation. The war has resolved many doubts, both national and local. It has demonstrated beyond further question the high character and loyal patriotism of our citizenry of whatever racial ancestry. The forthright support of President Truman, the championship of the former Secretary of the Interior, Mr. Issey, and of the present Secretary, Mr. Cruz, expresses the national government's approval of statehood for Hawaii now. The splendid report on our fitness for statehood, made by the subcommittee of the Committee on the Territories under Representative Lockheed as chairman, clears the way for the immediate consideration of an enabling act. The people of this community feel their apprenticeship has lasted long enough. They ardently desire that Hawaii take its place
as a full-fledged member of the family.
As one of the sovereign states of the Union, without further delay, statehood means the recognition by our fellow citizens of our maturity, their acknowledgement of our achievement as a unit of the American democracy, both in peace and in war. Statehood means that we will participate in national affairs on an equal basis with the other states of the Union. It grants us that full measure of self-government which is inherent in the American system. It guarantees us, as no other state can, security in our political and economic life that is every American's life. On the threshold of statehood, Hawaii's people are confident of their ability to maintain in the years ahead the splendid record of the past. We will accept our greater privileges as a state as a greater obligation upon us to serve our common democracy in complete loyalty to its ideals and institutions.
Thank you, Mr. Samuel W. King. We return you now to the National Hour in Washington.
In January of this year, for the third time since 1935, a joint congressional committee held hearings for 2 weeks in various cities of the islands. Testimony was taken from representatives of all groups, and for a brief recapitulation of both sides of the question of immediate statehood for Hawaii, the National Hour calls upon Representative Henry D. Larcade of Louisiana, who was chairman of that congressional subcommittee investigating the issues involved. What were some of those issues, pro and con, Mr. Larcade?
The subcommittee of the House Committee on Territories on Statehood for Hawaii, of which I had the honor to serve as chairman, recommended immediate consideration of this question by the full committee only after a most exhaustive investigation of the subject. The subcommittee visited and held hearings on all of the principal islands of the Hawaiian group and heard there more than 100 witnesses. The committee received testimony covering all aspects of life in this territory. It found among the people of the islands overwhelming sentiment in favor of immediate statehood, but gave every possible opportunity to those who were opposed to statehood to be heard. Testimony of the opponents of statehood, however, only served to strengthen the position of those supporting it. The foes of statehood expressed strong doubts as to whether or not the people of the territory were qualified to assume the responsibilities of statehood. The subcommittee's investigation proves beyond the shadow of a doubt that the people of Hawaii are not only loyal, but extremely patriotic Americans. The people of the territory, moreover, have a record in self-government over a long period of years that will do credit to any state. The committee left the territory convinced that the people of the islands were overwhelmingly in favor of statehood. In view of their record, they are entitled to admission as the 49th state. Opposition to statehood is so shadowy and flimsy as to scarcely present a worthy cause. Hawaii has proved itself reliable and efficient in its government. Its people are loyal. Hawaii would put a proud star in our flag. The time has come for Congress to act.
Thank you, Representative Larcade.
On February 22nd of this year, the committee submitted its report on Hawaii and recommended that the Committee on Territories give immediate consideration to legislation to admit Hawaii to full statehood.
Paradise now awaits a star in the American flag. On the subject of the territory of Hawaii, then, our documentary is closed.
But this is Robert St. John inviting you to listen to the National Hour again next Sunday when our subject will be the Paris Peace Conference, the settlement of war.
This has been the National Hour. From our studios in New York, Washington, and Honolulu, we have brought you the 36th of a series on current affairs and national problems. Our guest speakers were Delegate Joseph R. Farrington, Congressman Henry D. Larcade, and former Delegate Samuel W. King. Robert St. John was your narrator.